Okay, I have a question for you. You've been watching and listening to the exciting, that's the word for it, terrible news of the week this last week. How do you feel about the news? Even before last week and the bombings in Brussels, how did you feel, or how what was your overall feeling? What is your overall sense? Let's go back 6 months. Let's go back 12 months. Some of you are young, just beginning to plan out your lives, not quite finished high school, maybe looking toward, will you go toward a career, will you go for secondary education, will you go right into the workforce? Some of you are at the stage where you haven't made a commitment yet to the church, and you haven't, you're wondering, you know, what to do. It's an uncertain time in the world. On the other end of the scale, some are grandparents or great-grandparents, and you're concerned about, well, what's going to happen to our offspring, the way the world is going. Whatever our stage in life, it's impossible to be without some reaction to what is going on in the world around us. The average individual probably doesn't know a lot about what's going on outside of the United States. Probably the top of conversation around the water cooler is what's happening in the presidential election cycle, or gossip that's going on around that. American news media tends to get caught up in that kind of thing. But in the church, we're watching outside. We know about those terrible attacks in Brussels. We know that the government officials, the Minister of the Interior, and I've forgotten the other government minister equal to secretary, as we would say it in the United States, but both of them said it was impossible to anticipate this kind of attack happening in Belgium. But the average Belgium individual, like me and maybe like you, felt impossible. I mean, is your head in the sand? Are you stupid? How could it be impossible? They advertised that they were going to do it. The terrorists did. The ISIL or ISIS had said that they were going to attack all over Europe. We're quite aware of that. There's been a swing due to the reaction amongst the average citizenship within 3 days after the bombings. The right-wing party, it's sort of a white, ethnic white party, increased in size twice over. It grew 200% in 3 days. A similar thing is happening politically in Germany. The right-wing party that opposes immigration, specifically due to the problems that have resulted from immigration, the economy being hit, and the threat of terrorism, that party has increased greatly. It's now the third largest party in Germany, and it opposes Chancellor Merkel over there. We look at what's happening in the Middle East, always on our radar, in our focus, and we see that in spite of all that's been said in the Western press, that Iran is very obviously in the process of developing nuclear weapons, if it has not already done so, and it is in the process of developing the delivery method for those nuclear weapons. And we know that the world is not only likely to change, it is unlikely not to change drastically in the Middle East. Oh, there's always been war in the Middle East. But all we need now is not just an atomic drop on Tel Aviv. We need an atomic burst over Tel Aviv. And the electromagnetic pulse will set Israel back to the 5th century B.C. It'll make Israel no longer a modern nation. That's how close to the precipice of major change we are because of what's happening in Iran, and the doorway seems wide open to that. There is solid evidence after this bombing in Belgium of the existence of 400 to 600 highly trained individuals, men and women between the ages of 19 and 30, living in Europe, who are trained to do the kinds of things that these bombers did, whether they blow themselves up or whether they transport bombs or whether they help organize an activity, be the leader of it, or whether they make the bombs. These individuals are highly trained. And when I say trained, I don't mean they just went and sat in a classroom and they were trained like this. There are specific training camps specifically for this purpose in Syria, in Iraq, and in Eastern Europe, former Soviet satellite countries, where they are trained not only to do these things, but to do these things in Europe. It's very difficult to make the kind of bomb that was used in Belgium. It requires, of all things, hydrogen peroxide and acetone, you know, fingernail remover, and a few other things. But it's difficult chemically because the bombs have to be made drop by drop, and under controlled circumstances, the greatest danger is blowing the bomb maker up or having the bomb go off prematurely. And also, once the substance is created that makes the bomb, it begins to degenerate its power, its blast power, immediately. So the sooner it's used, the more effective it will be. The whole idea is make it, use it. 400 to 600 people are trained to do that, who now live in Europe and are scattered throughout Europe. They are not tied to Syria by telephone any electronic mean, any digital connection where there's command and control. They are free and, in fact, encouraged to act on their own. Will they strike Britain? Absolutely. Will they strike France again? Absolutely. Unless God intervenes to stop them, it's a given. How many of those men and women are in the United States right now? It's well known that a number of people who have fought in Syria have come back across the U.S. border and are in the country in various places. That's a pretty sobering and frightening situation. Economically, we look at the United States and we just scratch our heads in wonderment over the past few decades. And I'm not speaking politically one party versus another. When I say the past few decades of the pattern of spending by government officials in the United States at such a level that it is impossible for it to be repaid. There will never be enough tax revenue to pay for the commitments that have been made by the federal government. Impossible. It's not just, you know, we could talk like Ronald Reagan did about if you put a $100 bill on top of a $100 bill, it would reach to the moon or Mars or whatever and back, and then you get to a billion, and now we're up to 17, 20 plus trillion. It's not just trying to get the mind around the size of the money. It can never be repaid. And we wonder, what happened to common sense? What happened to unselfishness? What happened to thinking in terms of we're not building just for ourselves, we're building for our children. And we're building for our children's children. Now, and for generations it's been this way, Americans have thought, we're building to consume for ourselves. We're not looking ahead for the future. We are headed for, in this country, financial failure and, very likely, violence. Again, it's not just a question of if, it's a question of when and a question of how. Now, in the church, we know the prophecy we celebrated at the Feast of Tabernacles about the nations beating their swords into plowshares and their pruning hooks into or their implements of war into implements of farming. We rejoice in that time. That's the end. We know how it ends. Remember how Mr. Armstrong used to say, "I've read to the back of the book and we win." He said, "Yes, that's right. We do. We win." But we're not at the back of the book. Where we are right now is before Christ returns. And we've all read those prophecies, and we know they're in the book, and we know that the ethnos, nations in Greek, is ethnos, from which we get ethnic. And the prophecies about what the nations will do are just as much prophecies about what the ethnic groups will do. Whether they are Eastern European, whether they are Moroccan, or whatever their ethnicity is, the prophecy is about that. And we're concerned, we cannot help but be concerned, about what is going to happen between now and the time that the implements of war are made into implements of farming. Will that be you and me? Will it be our children? Will it be our grandchildren? We cannot say with certainty. But it does look like we might be on the precipice of all of that being fulfilled. And that's why I want to give this sermon today. The title of the sermon is A Bridge Over Troubled Waters. I want to make it clear to those who are concerned about their children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, and those who are in school and thinking in terms of future of marriage or whether they will be with the church or not with the church. I want to make it clear what God says for those who will be in His church and who are in His church. Let's begin with the big picture prophecy of Revelation chapter 12. This isn't about the place of safety, as the sermon is not, but chapter 12 is. People want to know, does the Bible teach a place of safety? And they might mistakenly quote Isaiah 16 or some other places. There is one verse in the Bible that absolutely, nailed down, speaks in terms of a place of safety, and we find that here in Revelation 17. Let's read the context, because many things are brought out here. Beginning in verse 7, war broke out in heaven at Michael and his angels fighting with the dragon symbolic of Satan, the dragon and his angels reciprocating and fighting back. And what a battle that must have been. You know, you see pitched warfare between highly trained forces, and it's pretty fearsome. I can only imagine what pitched warfare between angelic beings would be like. The angels of Satan, that is the demons, and then Satan himself, did not prevail, nor was there a place found for them in heaven any longer. Obviously, his office, being Lucifer, a coverer of God's throne, a close advisor of God, a teacher of other angels, that place, that position was gone. He rebelled against the government. He rebelled against the chairman of the board, tried to start his own company, however you want to phrase it. So he was out. There was no more place for him found in heaven. That does not mean he was unable to go to heaven after this. You can read in Job that Satan went to heaven and appeared before God. You can read in chapters in the other places in the Old Testament about lying spirits being before God. They could be there, but they had no place or any position. So the great dragon was cast out, that is, out of his position. The serpent of old, called the devil and Satan, who deceives the entire world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him, and they are in this place of restraint, Tartaru, translated hell in Peter. It just means that they are restrained to this area of earth. Maybe you've seen the analogies drawn where, and I understand Mr. Bradley's going to work for NASA, so he could tell you better than I can, but the earth could be represented by a little tiny ball, and the sun by an orange out there by in the parking lot, and that would only be a tiny representation of the galaxy that we're in. And then there are galaxies upon galaxies, and amongst all that we know God has created and can see God has created, Satan and the demons are restricted to this little tiny area, and their power is, in comparison, very limited. Nonetheless, that power, as far as you and I are concerned, is extensive. Then I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, "Now salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ have come, for the accuser of our brethren who accused them before our God day and night has been cast down, and they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, and they did not love their lives to the death," which means what it implies, that some of them were martyred. And that is just as sobering as the news events that I've been talking about. And there's no covering it up. You can look into past history and see that there has been martyrdom at different times. Probably most of the early disciples were martyred, perhaps all except John, and even the Apostle John may have been martyred well into his 90s, but he may have died a martyr's death. We don't know. "Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you having great wrath, because he knows that he has but a short time." I have on my desk a letter to answer. I haven't gotten to it yet. Somebody who corrects us and says, "Oh, you got it all wrong. The kingdom of God has come, because Revelation 12 says there's this battle. Satan is cast out. And when Satan is cast out, then the kingdom has come." And I'll write back to him and let him know no, it's not that way. I guess it's a she. Let her know that there's more to happen, that this is fulfilled at the end time when Satan comes down and sees that he has little time. Is that now? I don't know. People have said, oh, look, you know, for certain, Satan sees that he has little time and he's causing trouble right now. Yeah. How do you suppose people living in Europe felt during the bubonic plague when 2/3 of the world's population died? 2 out of every human beings on earth died. They might well have thought that Satan was making war on the earth. We cannot say that just because times are terrible that proves it. We can say that it does happen, and it will happen, because it's written down here in the book. They make war with the rest of her offspring. Let me back up here. I skipped over this. the important part here I was introducing. When the dragon saw that he had been cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman that gave birth to the male child. I won't take time to go through all the symbolism, but you understand the woman is the church, the male child is Christ, the persecution is directed against believers. And to the woman, to the church of God, was given 2 wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place, where she is nourished for a time, times, and half a time, from the presence of the serpent, blocked from the presence of the serpent. What is the eagle? At one time, I can remember people standing up in church and saying it's the C-5A. It was a military plane that had just been developed. You can drive full-sized tanks up the ramp, and they are able to carry a tremendous number of people. And there was speculation that the church members, and maybe not just speculation, maybe direct statements, that the church members will be put in these C-5As and flown to the Middle East, and the place of safety would be in Petra or Petra, and it would all work out that way. Well, the eagle is symbolic of God taking people to protection. I don't know. If it's an airplane, if it's a train, if it's a boat, if it's some other means of God transporting. In the Exodus, and God rescuing Israel out of Egypt, it is spoken of as an eagle being the rescuer. So it is a symbolic of God's rescuing. And we know that time, times, and half a time is undeniably specific to the period just before Christ returns. It's mentioned in Daniel. It's mentioned in other places in the book of Revelation. It's mentioned as 3.5 years, 1,260 days, 40 and 2 months. 3 different ways that it's mentioned. All the same time frame, all the time of the end. Was the Church of God protected during persecution at earlier times in history? Yes. Did that fulfill this prophecy? No. There's only one complete fulfillment of this prophecy, and it is at the end. And this is the verse in the Bible that says the church does go to a place of safety, her place. And Satan cannot get to her there when he is absolutely determined to destroy the church at that point. So that is, as they say, you can take it to the bank. Although these days I don't know what bank you take it to. You have to be careful about that. The earth helps the woman, opens up its mouth, swallows the flood, symbolic of an army, which the dragon spewed out of its mouth. And the dragon was enraged with the woman and went to make war with the rest of her offspring. What is the offspring of the church? Who are the children of the church? Well, they are believers as well. And they are so identified, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. I cannot go through this without commenting on how we have been tempted to read into this scripture over the years and say, the rest of her offspring, who are the Laodiceans and who need to be given a whack upside the head or a boot in the backside in order to get them going. But it does not say that. It does not say these are people who are weak in faith. It does not say that these are people who are sagging in their commitment. It says, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. Does God tend to allow severe trials on people who are weak in the faith to wake them up? Sometimes. Sometimes in extreme mercy, he very gently massages them through the times and maybe allows them to be around other people who are quite strong, and they realize, I can pull through, I can make it. We should not make the assumption that there is a group of people that we could call Laodicean that are going to go through tribulation, not be protected because they need it. They just need to be toughened up a little bit. If you have an animal that's weak, you're a herdsman or a rancher, do you tend to leave it out in the cold? Do you expose it to predators? Or do you cage it? Or do you put it in a shelter and give it extra nourishment and extra care because you want it to grow strong? You know, we have to think through these things and not just make assumptions. I want to draw five conclusions here in summary of this scripture. Number one, Satan will unleash a time of unparalleled evil upon both physical and spiritual Israel. Physical Israel, still, we believe, is the United States, Great Britain, many of her former Commonwealth members. You have to be careful. You cannot say, and the former Commonwealth members. Nor can you say the English-speaking Commonwealth members. Do you know that India is an English-speaking Commonwealth member? The descendants of Israel are not just so easily summarized, but nonetheless, punishment will come upon physical and spiritual Israel. Spiritual Israel being the church. I don't mean punishment, but I mean persecution. Number two, Satan will cause the death of some. But do not assume that Satan will cause the death of all that he persecutes or whom he persecutes. The Bible does not say everyone who suffers persecution will become a martyr. Don't let yourself get so down and so discouraged about that. Number three, he will cause persecution of the saints. That's a given. We will face persecution. That is, if this is the end, we will face persecution for our beliefs. Number four, the main body of the church will be supernaturally protected. Number five, some who believe the same as those who are protected, her offspring, will be outside the place of safety. And what will happen to them? Well, first, what should we be concerned about when we are persecuted? We know the persecution is going to come, so what should be on our minds? It's very sobering to think that we're going to be persecuted, but you know what Christ's counsel is about that? Don't overthink it. It's very hard to say. Persecution, you mean, I've read about what ISIS does to those whom they think are Christians in the Middle East, and they use swords and bullets, and I won't be gruesome here, but we know how gruesome persecution can be. And you want to tell me that Christ's advice was don't overthink that? And yes, I do, because that is what his advice is. Matthew chapter 10. And beginning in verse 18. I'm going to read this from the Amplified Version. The publishers of the Amplified Version have come out with a new version. I don't know if you have the Amplified Version, but they came out with one, I think, in 2015, just last year. And this is from the new one. And all of the quotes from the Amplified that I use in the sermon will be from the new one. And you will be brought before governors and kings for my sake as witnesses to them and to the Gentiles. Gentiles meaning, again, ethnos or ethnic groups or entire nations. God intends to use human beings to be witnesses, which means people who explain his thinking. Don't be confused by the evangelical approach of, I'm going to witness for Christ. I'm going to tell you what is done for my heart, and I'm going to stand up for Christ and give my testimony. Don't be confused by that. Think in terms of witnesses. And now the defense will call Mrs. So-and-so as a witness for the defense, or the prosecution will call Mr. So-and-so as a witness for the prosecution, that type of witness, where God's people will be called upon to explain what we believe, why we believe it, why we know it is so. But when they hand you over, here's Christ's counsel: do not worry. Other translations say, do not be anxious about how or what you are to say, for what you are to say will be given to you within that very hour. Now, if any of you are in university or school, wouldn't it be great to know that you're headed toward the final exams, and I mean, everything is riding on this exam, and someone tells you, don't worry about it, because it's going to come to you when the question comes. The answer is going to be right there. Exactly how to phrase it, exactly how to put it, you're going to ace it. Well, that'd be great to have that kind of confidence. That's the kind of confidence that Jesus says that we ought to have as we head into persecution. Because it is not you speaking, but the Spirit of your Father speaking through you. If we overthink, what are you going to do? You're going to prepare in advance. You're going to prepare your testimony, what you're going to respond to the prosecutor's questions or the attorney's questions in advance. And that's not what Christ wants us to give. He wants us to give what the Father wants us to say. John 14, verse 26, contains another promise to believers. And this, too, I'll read from the Amplified. John 14, verse 26, and this and the next verse are part of the final words that Christ spoke on the last Passover. They will go over in the Passover ceremony in a few weeks. But he said, the helper, a comforter, an advocate, an intercessor, a counselor, a strengthener, a standby, meaning one to stand by you or stand with you, and these are all adjectives that are included in the translation as alternate ways to translate that word parakletos, or helper or comforter, as it is in some translations. The Holy Spirit that the Father will send in my name, in my place, to represent me, to act on my behalf, it will teach you all things, just as I said earlier. It will help you remember everything that I have told you. You ever been in a conversation after which, maybe a day later or 2 days later, you find yourself thinking, I should have said, oh, if only I had thought about this at the time. Or maybe you're relating the account to someone else and the person said, well, did you say? And you go, oh, I should have said that. Well, you won't have to bang your poor old head, because the Spirit of God will give you what it is that you need to remember from Jesus Christ. Then in chapter 16, verse 33, Jesus spoke to the apostles, true for them, truer still for the people who live into the Great Tribulation or up to the time of the Great Tribulation. John 16:33, I have told you these things so that in me you may have perfect peace. Peace is not the first emotion that comes to me when I hear of such a thing as the bombing in Brussels. That was not my first reaction. My insides tightened up. But Jesus wants us to have perfect peace. In the world, you have tribulation and distress and suffering. It's a statement of fact. You have it. And by you, we know by experience that some of that you includes some of us have tribulation and distress and suffering. We do not escape all things physical. But whatever you have, whether it's with you or those around you, be courageous. With your courage, be confident, be undaunted, be filled with joy. Imagine that, being filled with joy at such a time or during such an experience. Why? He says, I have overcome the world. The world is about to take you on, but I'm with you. It already took me on, and I won. So you can have complete confidence that it'll be okay. My conquest is accomplished and my victory is abiding. Will the true believers not taken to the place of safety all be martyred? I said some will be martyred. That's inescapable. I mentioned the main body of the church will be protected. That's the implication of Revelation 12. What about those who are outside the place of safety? Are they the ones who will be martyred? We should not make that assumption. Stop to think about the name of the man who is synonymous with bringing bad news to God's people. Jeremiah, right? Well, so you're a bringer of bad news from God. What are you, a Jeremiah? It's in the vernacular. It's in the English language. Jeremiah brought the news of the conquest of God's people by Babylon, which was a prototype of the greatest destruction on earth, which will be brought by a spiritual Babylon at the end of the age. And Jeremiah survived physically. He did not die and supernaturally resurrected. He physically survived. So the main messenger didn't die in that case. Notice Matthew 24, verse 21. It's a memory verse. I know you know it. But I want you to look at it and see something that you might not have seen or might not have thought about it while you were looking at it before. For then there will be great tribulation. What we're talking about here in the sermon today is what comes just before tribulation, from here, where we are now, to there, the great tribulation. So Christ, what we're reading about now is there. Then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world, no, not until this time, no, nor ever shall be. Now, you need to be a student of history. Everybody needs to be a student of history. You may not like it as much as some do, but certainly you know, if you've read any of history, that there have been terrible times, times of terrible human suffering, times of great evil done by human beings to human beings. And you stop and you think about what has been done against Christ's statement that nothing has ever been done as bad as what will happen just before the Great Tribulation. And that only sobers us further. That's pretty serious. But then he continues, unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. Humanity would not survive. I mentioned before, 2 out of 3 human beings died. This time, 3 out of 3 would perish under the circumstances of the very end. But, oh, thankfully, there's a but. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. God's mind is on his overall plan. He wants all human beings to be in his kingdom. He wants all people to be his sons and daughters eventually. He can accomplish that by allowing them to die and then resurrecting them as spirit. But he says that's not the way he's going to handle it in the future. For the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. He will not require every human being to die through suffering, under persecution. Obviously, those in the place of safety will be saved from it. So this means other people will not be required to die. It's not a promise that all people will escape martyrdom. But it is a promise that God's mind is on his elect. You know, those people who are wondering, well, the church is going to undergo persecution. I don't know if I want to be a part of the church. That's not the way to think. The way to think is this. Is God calling me? If the answer is yes, then you are part of the elect. That's the question. Are you part of the elect? Have you been selected for the opportunity? It's not, do I want to take this ride on the fair, or do I want to buy this sports car, or do I want to take this job, or do I want to marry this individual, ranging from small decision to major decisions. It's the greatest possible decision, and it's not a decision for us to reach out and take if it's not offered to us. If it is offered to us, our decision is whether we will respond to it or not. And of those who respond, we are on God's mind. We are part of his thinking as we head into this part of the time frame in the beginning of the Great Tribulation. In Revelation 7, verses 1 to 4, I don't think I'll take the time to go there and read that, but that's the promise of the protection or the salvation of the 144,000. I don't know. Maybe I better read it just in case, because people make their own, not that you would, but there are people making their own doctrines out of this. about the 144,000. Revelation 7, after these things I saw the four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth, the wind that should not blow, that the wind should not blow on the earth, on the sea, or on any tree. In other words, the angels are there ready for the final burst. The tribulation is about to begin, and God says, wait. I saw another angel ascending from the east, having the seal of the living God, and he cried with a loud voice to the four angels who had the power to release the deadly events that God is going to allow, saying, don't harm earth, sea, or trees until we have sealed the servants of our God on their foreheads. And I won't take time to go through Ephesians to show you that the sealing is conversion. But in essence, don't do this until these people are converted. Who are they? I heard the number, and the number are 12,000 from Judah, 12,000 from Reuben, 12,000 from Gad, etc., etc., etc. Ephraim and Manasseh have 12,000 each. Joseph is not mentioned separately. And Dan is not mentioned as having being one of the, or part of the 144,000. But the point is, God is going to call people to conversion as physical human beings, preserving them alive in a time of tremendous trouble on earth. These are not even yet part of the church. But he's going, this is done so that they can become a part of the church. How much more is God going to do for those who are part of the church? Well, anything that is necessary. And God does not convert people as in terms of the one major religion thinks that, you know, you just get a person converted and then kill them and then at least they go to heaven. Or a baby that may die in birth, so you baptize it in utero and then it'll go to someplace in between earth and heaven, but eventually make it to heaven. The whole idea is to, quote, get converted and then you'll get to heaven. We think in terms of the kingdom of God. God's approach is not just a person becomes converted, baptized, has the laying on of hands, and then bang, the resurrection comes. No, what is necessary? It is necessary for a person to continue in the faith to which he commits, or to which she commits. There must be a period of time after baptism. How long a time? God knows. I do not. But God knows that there is a time that is necessary for a person to prove his commitment. And it's not only the 144,000, but you continue to read in the chapter, and many more than John could count, a great innumerable multitude who are not Israelites, will also come out of the tribulation as saints. They'll be converted. They'll be baptized. And hands will be laid on them. And then they will prove their faithfulness to God before the end of the great tribulation. Well, wait a minute. Who's going to counsel them for baptism? Who's going to baptize them? Who's going to lay hands on them? They're going to counsel themselves. They're going to figure it out. They're going to baptize themselves. Huh. Maybe that's why God does not place some in the place of protection. Maybe some who are not actually weak and need a slap upside the head, but some who are strong, some who are trained to be able to teach others, some who are trained to be able to lay hands on others, some who are trained to be able to baptize others and to lead others and to raise up churches. Maybe some of those will not be in a place of safety. It's interesting to think about. Matthew 24, how long? Well, let me go there and just pick up this so you know the subject. This is the return of the Son of Man. As you know, Matthew 24, Luke 21, and Mark 13 are all about. Matthew 24, verse 29. Immediately after the tribulation of these days, so here we are. We've gone through this period that I'm talking about. The tribulation has begun. The tribulation passes, and it's over, and Christ is returning. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon won't give its light, the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heaven will be shaken, and the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes on the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. Oh, wait a minute. Didn't you think that when Christ returns, bang, boom, there'll be the sound of a trumpet, and Christ will be returned, the saints will suddenly be spirit, and it'll all happen just that quickly? Here it says, all the tribes of the earth mourn as they see the sign of the Son of Man, implying that there's at least some time that the sign of the returning Christ is in the heavens before he actually comes to the earth and the resurrection of the saints takes place. And the timing of all that, I won't speculate on whether the saints are resurrected immediately when the sign of the Son of Man appears or not. But you can check this out in Revelation chapter 1 and verse 7, and it says the same thing, that all of the tribes of the earth will mourn when they see the Son of Man returning. So there is a period of time that passes. The Bible Knowledge Commentary suggests that converts are made during this time. People who are not in a place of safety, people who weren't converted before. Verse 31, at this time he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the heavens to the other. Is this the first resurrection? Does 1 Thessalonians 4 say that when Christ returns, the angels will go gather the saints and bring them to one spot, and then they will rise and meet Christ in the air? Doesn't say anything about angels gathering the saints. This appears to be talking about something else. It appears to be talking, as this Bible commentary, the Bible Knowledge Commentary suggests, it appears to be talking about human beings with whom God is dealing and who are coming to conversion right up through the Great Tribulation. Now, I said they needed time to prove themselves. Some of the proving they can be doing before they're actually baptized, just like some of us, I say us, I didn't have that privilege, some of us grow up in the faith, and we go through trials over the Sabbath, we go through trials over the holy days, we go through trials of faith, we go through trials of conscience before we are baptized. And God is working with us, even though we have not yet had the laying out of hands and received God's Spirit fully. How does God feel about those who believe in and practice his way of life? I'm talking about those who have made a commitment. I was having a conversation recently with people, noticed as I have, that we have a contingent in the church that kind of floats. You know, think in terms of a drink that you have, and the drink is made of various ingredients, and some of them get stirred in, and after they're stirred in, some of them mix with whatever it is that you're mixing, then some float to the top. They just never mix. In the Church of God, and it has been this way for a couple of decades anyway, we have some, quote, Christians who are always floating at the top. Are they members of this organization? We're CAGWA, so let's say, are they members of CAGWA? Well, floating on the top. They're sometimes in the mix, and sometimes they're floating on the top. Now, obviously, there have to be some who are in the mix, who are solidly a member of CAGWA. Otherwise, there would not be a hall. There would not be snacks, coffee. There would not be messages. There would not be feast sites and so on. There has to be a structure. There has to be commitment. Am I criticizing those who are floating at the top? Well, I'm bringing it to their awareness so they will be thinking about it. Because I believe the Bible teaches that at some point you do have to become part of the mixture. You cannot always be floating at the top, unattached, quote, independent. I know all about organized churches and it's me and God and all that. Well, where did organized churches come from? Christ. You want to float at the top forever? I don't think Christ will take those floating at the top. He'll take those that are part of the body. It seems like I read that somewhere. Part of the body. Something to think about. How does God think about those who are part of the people who practice his way of life. I am not assuming or implying that all of those people are members of CAGWA. I'm saying that in an informed way, those who practice and are committed to his way of life. Malachi chapter 3. Malachi 3, verse 16, some of my favorite verses, 16 through 18. Then those who feared the Eternal or feared the Lord spoke to one another, and the Lord listened and heard them. What's people who fear the Lord speaking to one another? It's called fellowship. It's a word that's overused in evangelical Christianity to the point of it loses its sense after a while. Like love, you've got to have love. God is love, the love of Christ, and so on. And they're wonderful words and powerful words, but they lose their effectiveness because they're overused. And fellowship can lose its effectiveness. I had a telephone conversation with a school teacher in New Jersey recently who called the church to ask for information. And every question he asked, I answered. And every time I answered, he said, oh, I wish I was at my computer right now so I could look that up. And oh, he was just so excited. And I was excited because it was like days in the past when I'm working with someone who's obviously called and who understands and who's made a commitment already and wants to be a part of things. And he wanted to come to the Sabbath services that we have in the New York City area. And he lived not too far away from where the church meets. And I asked, are you keeping the Sabbath? And he said, yes. But he says, one Sabbath a month, I have to come in to the school for a few hours a day as part of a tutoring program. And we help young people who are behind to catch up. And he knew what was right and what wasn't because he volunteered then, but I am paid for it. It's part of my contract. So he knew it was part of his job. And I said, well, you know, you want to think about the word fellowship, because he mentioned it. And I said, that's extremely important. It reinforces your faith. It helps you build your faith. People who aren't able to fellowship sometimes aren't able to grow as quickly and as firmly as people who are able to fellowship. However, the word fellowship implies that you are with a fellow. That you are walking the same path, that you are of the same mind, that you have the same commitment. Now, if you go to Sabbath services with people who are Sabbath keepers and have been, and some of them have laid their jobs on the line to be able to do so, will you be able to fellowship in the same way you would if you worked all of that out? No, I'm not saying you can't. I'm just saying it's something for you to think about. And I put him on to welcome to the Church of God, a worldwide association booklet. If you haven't read it, it's on CAGWA.org. It's a wonderful booklet. It is not just a PR piece. It truly introduces the church. It's what people read before they come and meet you. So you should read it so you'll know what they expect of you when they come through the door. It talks about the church and our programs from the young to the no longer young. My doctor told me not long ago in talking about my liver, you know, we're talking about people whose livers are well, younger than yours. The doctor is very tactful. But fellowship is important. It is wonderful. It is part of our spiritual growth. And think about the fact that when we fellowship, you say, hey, hi, good to see you. Happy Sabbath. How do you do? My name is... God is listening. God is listening. You say, how are you? I've been praying about your situation. How's your health? That's been a concern to me. God is listening. Doesn't he have better things to do than to listen to what we fellowship about? Oh, you better believe he's got a lot of things to do. But this, apparently, is very important to him. The Lord listened and heard them. And a book of remembrance was written before him. Oh, not only he listens to it, like the NSA picks up all the conversations, probably this one too. God picks up on our conversations and our fellowship, or our lack of it. A book of remembrance was written for those who fear the Eternal and who meditate on his name. Are we caught up in Satan's trap of being busy, 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 busy? Oh, I've got my cell phone. I've got my... You know how many people who contact us and read the material on LHT do so through a smartphone or a tablet as opposed to a desktop or a laptop? 34.6% use a desktop or a laptop. About 65% use a smartphone or a tablet. Because you're busy. I'm busy. I use a tablet. I'm too old to use a smartphone. I went to replace my phone not too long ago and thought I was smart. I went looking for it and I found Verizon has an entire department called Smartphones for Seniors. Or not smartphones for seniors, whatever they call it. And I have a phone that I don't use for that. That's a different subject. But are we so busy, is the point, that we do not meditate on, which means to stop and to spend a concentrated amount of time, let's say 10 to 15 minutes at least, thinking about one subject that has to do with God, Christ, their way of life, a doctrine, you practicing it, you picture yourself doing it, you picture yourself failing, correcting, changing it. That's very good exercise to do by meditation. Those who meditate on his name, they'll be mine, says the Eternal of Hosts, on that day that I make them my jewels. And oh, that tickles my heart. How many jewels do you suppose God has? All of them. You ever think in terms of a beautiful jewel you would like to have? Probably the ladies more than the men. Although I'm an unusual man, I appreciate jewelry and I appreciate flowers in their beauty, maybe more than some men do, but just a quirk of mine. But God appreciates jewelry, and he can have any that he wants, anything that he wants. If he doesn't have it, he makes it. But what does he want? What's he going to make a jewel out of? These days you can cremate your loved one and have him turned into a jewel and wear him or her in a ring. I'm not saying whether you should or shouldn't, but I'm just saying it's done. But God is going to take us, and he's not going to cremate us and make us into jewels, but living children, and we're going to be his jewels. That's how special we are to him. On the day that I will make them my jewels, and I will spare them, as a man spares his own son who serves him. And then you will again discern between the righteous and the wicked, between the one who serves God and the one who does not serve him, because the one who serves God is spared. It's very important. That's a promise from God that God will spare his jewels. There are numerous scriptures that speak in terms of God giving protection to the people that he loves. One outstanding fact about the way God introduced the covenant that he made with Abram, whose name he later changed to Abraham, and who's called the father of the faithful. And God made that covenant which promised the land of Israel from the Mediterranean Sea over past what is now the Euphrates and up to what is now southern Turkey and down to and including what is Saudi Arabia. All of that general area was what was promised to Abraham as the promised land. And then eventually it came down to what we knew of as Israel under Solomon or David's time, and then Saul's time, and then David's and Solomon's and so on. And then eventually the whole world was promised to Abraham. Romans 4 tells us that. And that's what this covenant is about to introduce. But the very first thing God says to Abram is, Genesis 15, verse 1, "Hello, Abram, I am your shield." And the word shield means shield, that which you hold out in front of you to stop the arrows, or these days the lasers, that which protects you. Hello, I'm your protector. Very first thing out of your mouth. You could have said, I'm your father, or I'm going to be your father, and that was a part of it. But what he said was, I'm your protector. Psalm 121 and Psalm 91 are both beautiful psalms of protection. There are many places I could go in the Bible to deal with this subject, but I just want to look at Psalm 91 for a few moments. But you can put Psalm 121 down in your notes, too, as one to read on your own. Or just to look up the word shield and do some meditation/Bible study on that. Meditation can be guided by Bible study or be in conjunction with that, dealing with one subject. I'm going to do what you have to do with computers here in a minute, which is reboot it, meaning I'm going to throw it out the window. This psalm is overwhelmingly encouraging. It speaks of believers having a secret place to go to. Do you remember a secret place as a child where you went to and nobody could see you? Of course, maybe mom and dad knew where you were all the time and nobody could see you. We had one home when my three older children were young and had a secret closet that they could go to and enjoy in a huge old house, big old fun house that I know that they enjoyed very much. There is a place to go to. You ever feel like that? Like, man, the debt I owe, or this pain I feel, or how I feel about my friend and what she's going through. I just want to go behind a door somewhere and shut it and just shut everything out. I'd like to go and hide in a closet. Secret place. That's what this psalm speaks about, God being. He who dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. Maybe as a young person, when the bullies were after you, you went and hid behind mom or dad. Not to hide behind mom's skirts, but there are times when we say, my dad is bigger than your dad, and God is bigger than whatever it is that we're facing. And that's what this psalm talks about. Gives you the analogy of you being delivered from the snare of the fowler. The fowler is a hunter, someone out to get you, to kill you. That's what these terrorists are. They are out to get and kill innocent people. We can look forward to, just as now we take our shoes off before we get on an airplane and have them go through the x-ray, we can look forward to our suitcases undergoing special scrutiny at the door of the airport before they go in to be checked as baggage, because these last bombers were able to put bombs in the bombs and get them behind the check-in counter. So it's going to change the way everybody flies. Some things change everything. How will you feel the next time you go stand in line at the American Airlines counter? Any of you headed through the airport in Belgium as you go to the feast? How will you feel the next time you fly in a high-volume place? Here it says that God will deliver us from the trap that is set. I like having that verse in my pocket as part of my promise of protection. You know, we have the Zika disease that's come out of nowhere, and turns out it's been around for years, but nobody's ever allowed it or mentioned it. There's a modern form of tuberculosis that few people have talked about that's more virile than the one that was so deadly a few generations ago that's coming back. There is a new type of MRSA, or a MRSA-like disease, that started in China, and it crossed the animal-human barrier line, but the Chinese thought they isolated it in one part of China, and they were very careful not to let it get out because no known antibiotic will kill it. But it has turned up in an Eastern European country, and it has turned up in another country, in another part of the world, in people who have no connection whatsoever with China. They haven't been in touch with Chinese. They haven't traveled to China. They haven't eaten Chinese food. No connection whatsoever. But these diseases, you just cannot keep away from. You cannot protect yourself from them. But here's a promise that says, I will protect you from the perilous pestilence. The analogies go on, and it says God is like the hen that gathers the chicks under the wings, and we've seen that in real life and can picture that. It's a wonderful promise. It's the shield and buckler is mentioned again. Verse 5, you'll not be afraid of the terror by night. Very appropriate promise. Or the arrow, which could also mean missile, be the same word that would be used if we were to write about missile today, that flies by day. Or the pestilence that walks in darkness, or destruction that lays waste at noonday. 1,000 may fall at your side and 10,000 at your right hand. God forbid that we would go through that, but some of us may see people die right next to us, right in front of us. Not just one or two, but hundreds or even thousands. But then the promise, but it shall not come near you. Only with your eyes you will look and you will see the reward of the wicked, because you have made the Lord, who is my refuge, even the Most High, your dwelling place. You crossed that line. You made that commitment in your mind. You said, yes, God has called me. And yes, sir, I appreciate that. And thank you, Jesus Christ, for being willing to lay down your life for my sins. And I will commit myself to obeying your way of life from this point on. And because you have done that, I promise you this, says God. No evil will befall you, nor any plague come near your dwelling. He will give his angels charge over you. Yeah, that's the scripture that Satan quoted to Jesus when he was being tempted, to keep you in all your ways. In their hands they will bear you up, lest you dash your foot against the stone. You will tread on the lion and the cobra, the young lion and the serpent. You'll trample underfoot, because he has set his love upon me, says God. Therefore I will deliver him. And some of you are thinking in your minds, well, wait a minute, I know about somebody who wasn't delivered from a pestilence, and I know somebody who was caught up in an accident. I'm looking forward to the time when God reads back to me all the times that the angels were there and did stop something happening to me, my loved one. It's a big book, I'm sure. Yes, God does allow things to happen to his people, and for reason. That's a different subject. But these are our major promises, and these are things to meditate on, and these are reasons to be positive about even the difficult times that we're going through. Look at another specific prophecy about the time immediately prior to Christ's return in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. I'm not going to deal with the main subject, so I won't go through each of these verses word by word. This is about the false prophet who comes just before Christ returns. I'll only say this, that there is a Church of God group that teaches that this was all fulfilled at the end of the first century, and this is not just before Christ returns. And to which I say, just read the context, which says Christ stops the false prophet at his coming. That tells me that Christ is going to stop the false prophet when Christ returns. Not that it happened centuries ago. But this is about the false prophet. In the first few verses it says, don't be troubled if you get a letter or you hear word from us, as though it's from us, saying Christ has already returned or the resurrection has already taken place. You know that certain things are going to have to happen before the end comes. And you have to know prophecy in order to be able to understand all that will happen. Some people will be deceived. They'll be confused. Even believers, they'll give up. People come along who always kind of wanted a following, and other people who are a little gullible will zip off, leave the church, go off after them. We've seen that happen, even in recent years. How can you make sure that you stay away from that, and that you're preserved, and that God protects you? Verse 10 explains those who are able to avoid being deceived. And with all unrighteous deception among those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth, that they might be saved. If you have the love of the truth, you will be saved, is the other way to look at that. You just flip it over. So there is a promise. You have the love of the truth, you will be saved. And that requires being familiar with God's truth. You know, we look at Bible study, and we talk about Bible study sometimes as saying, well, you need to study the Bible so many minutes every day and do it regularly. And you can think of it almost as a ritual. No, that's not the point. It's as in Malachi, thinking often on God's name. And as in 2 Thessalonians, it's loving the truth. You have to be familiar with it to love it. You have to meditate on God to be close with him. In Revelation chapter 3, a very specific verse found about the Great Tribulation, in the message to the angel of the church of Philadelphia, verse 10, because you have kept my command to persevere, I also will keep you from the hour of trial, which will come upon the whole world to test those who dwell upon the earth. That's the time of great tribulation. There are two ways that God can keep us, I suppose three ways, that God can keep us from great tribulation. One is he can allow us to die. That's a pretty secure way to keep us from it. It's not a cheerful way from my point of view. A second way is he can include us in a place of safety and protect us that way. A third way is he can have us out serving other people who are not protected, who are out there in the world and who are learning the truth, helping to baptize them and convert them, and he can supernaturally protect us the same way he's going to protect the two witnesses. Is there anybody in your family who's one of those, are we there yet, kids? I had a daughter like that. Any trip we ever took, are we there yet? It's so frustrated. Finally, I just learned to take it as a game. And I'd say, yeah, we've been there for 2 hours. I've just been circling, just waiting for you to say that. Well, are we there yet? Are we now on the downhill slide, and are we headed right toward the Great Tribulation? You know what the answer is? It's impossible to know. This is another thing that we have to be careful not to overthink. You've heard watch world news. Do we watch world news so we'll know when the end will come? Let me show you some things that might surprise you. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. But concerning the times and the seasons, brethren, you don't need that I should write to you, for you yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so comes for those who have been watching in a way that they'll understand perfectly the timing. No, it doesn't say that. It says the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night. Well, wait a minute. It doesn't mean that for the church people. Oh, wait. Christ said it there. He says it in Luke 21, says it in Matthew 24, says it in 2 Peter. Christ said it in Revelation 16, where it's inserted right in the midst of the time of God's wrath has come in terms of chronology. The tribulation is already finished. It's already too late to worry about being protected, because either you're protected or not by that point. But this is for us to read beforehand so we would have in mind, I come like a thief. You don't know when I come. When they say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes on them like labor pains on the pregnant woman, and they don't escape. But you, brethren, are not in darkness, so that this day should overtake you as a thief. You're sons of the light and sons of the day. We're not of the night or of the darkness. And what does that mean? I said, you can't see. What does it mean then? It means, if we are watching ourselves, if we're practicing God's way of life, we're not going to slip into the way of sin and be taken away from the church that will be protected. That's what being awake means. He says those who get drunk are drunk at night. Drunk meaning the mind befuddled and confused and not alert to what it needs to be alert to. Put this together with Luke 21, the section of the Bible that talks of watching and that is so often quoted. Luke 21, verse 34. Take heed of yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, and the cares of this life, and that day come on you unexpectedly. He is talking to disciples and to believers whose hearts can be caught off guard. It will come as a snare on all those who dwell on the face of the earth. Why? Because they are not watching their hearts, their minds. They're not watching what is occupying them and how much care or how much priority they're putting on different areas of their life. How can you determine how much priority you're putting on an area of your life? Answer, how much time are you giving to it? Watch, therefore, and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass before the day of the Son of Man. What are you watching? We're not watching to know when. We're watching to know so that we will not be caught off guard. Watchful people are not caught off guard. When you're out hunting and you're watchful, you see the deer. You see that turkey moving over there. If you're a soldier and you're in the field of battle and you're watchful, you see the enemy encroaching. If you're in this world and your time is consumed with family, work, and fun, and sports, and this and that, and there's no time for God or for the way of studying God's way of life or serving other people, you can't commit to come in and set up before church or commit to stay after and be the one to close up church, or you can't commit to go look for a new church hall or to help plan a social because your time is committed elsewhere. That's what we have to watch for. We have to watch how we're managing ourselves so that we will not be caught off guard. We will not know it is a time of the end until the end is here. Then we'll know with certainty. The downward slide into tribulation will come when people least expect it. The thief in the night, you want to remember. Now, we have choices to make every day, but we have the major choice to make of our lifetime, and that is whether we will commit to God's way of life. We can commit to it now. And sometimes people think if you commit to it now, you've got a rough road ahead. Persecution, I don't know, Satan getting after me. But part of my point is that we open our eyes and look around and look at the world. The world has a rough ride ahead. What is happening in the world now is going to happen in Israel. It's already happening in other parts of the world. That is to say, you can't step back from the church and step back from trouble. Trouble is coming anyway. Each who step forward to be with the church and with God and respond to his calling, you will go through trouble in some form or another if you live until the time of tribulation. However, you have all of these promises that we've gone through and more. I want to finish in Psalm 23. Maybe that's been on your mind, but listen to it and think about it with the backdrop of what we've just gone through. It's a short psalm. You probably have it memorized. The Lord is my shepherd. You say, my financial manager is, you know, Merrill or whatever financial manager you want to mention. My captain is, and mention a special ops operator. My president is, and mention your political hero, if you have such a thing. In the church, we say, my captain, my shepherd, is the Lord. I will not lack. I won't lack for ammunition. I won't lack for shelter. I won't lack for the plans. I won't lack for knowing what's going to happen. I won't lack for knowing what's expected of me. He makes me to lie down where the pastures are green. That is where there's nourishment and I'll have what I need to eat. He makes me to lie down where the waters are still, where they're pure enough for me to drink. He restores my soul. How many times have we been through situations where we wish we could take the pump and just kind of be filled up inside again and feel like we once felt when we felt secure and we felt safe and everything was good. God does that for us when we draw close to him. He leads me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yes, though I walk, and I may well walk, through the valley of the shadow of death. That doesn't mean that you're going to die. The valley of the shadow of death means in dangerous places. It refers to the time when shepherds would take sheep through mountainous areas in which there were coyotes, if there were coyotes at the time, but foxes or wolves or panthers or lions or whatever, and the sheep's lives were in danger. And even though they were going through dangerous areas, valleys that were shadowed where predators could hide, they weren't afraid because of their shepherds who had the staff and rod. And their shepherds were so capable that they would not fear them. So even though I walk through that valley, I fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod, your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me, right in the presence of my enemies, and you anoint me. I am chosen. That makes me special above other people, but it makes me special in your eyes, and I feel special because you have chosen me, knowing I don't deserve it. My cup runs over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever.